Welcome to the Gordon Asset Management Podcast.
Simply flooded the system with money.
Yes, we did.
Where does it come from? Do you just print it?
We print it digitally.
When you give people money that don't need it, they feel like they're playing with the house's money. So it actually does resemble a casino.
Give me some of that. Give me some of that money. I want some of that money.
Now, on to the show.
Welcome to the Gordon Asset Management Podcast. This is your host, Todd Zempel. My friends call me Z. You can call me Z. And today on the podcast, we invited back one of our favorite guests, James Abate. James is the Chief Investment Officer of Center Asset Management and also the Portfolio Manager on the firm's American Select Equity and Global Listed Infrastructure Strategies. So, James, welcome back to the show. Glad to have you back.
My pleasure.
Now, James, you recently published your firm's Fall Winter 21 to 22 Market Review and Outlook, which is available on centerfunds.com. That's center, C-E-N-T-R-E, funds.com for anybody that wants to check it out. But can you break down the salient points from that outlook for us, please?
Absolutely. I think when you look at the investment landscape right now, where you have negative real interest rates across the interest rate curve, you have junk bonds for the very first time in history trading below with a yield below the rate of inflation. So in essence, free money, which is why we're seeing so much activity with regard to mergers and acquisitions and other places. Stocks trading on an equal weighted basis, the most expensive they've ever been in history. You've got commodity prices moving higher. You have a lot of, discussion with regard to what is the root cause of why the consumer price inflation is at the highest level that we've seen since 1990. You've got concerns about potential change in the Federal Reserve chairmanship. You've got issues with regard to congressional stimuli being further gasoline on an already hot economy, and particularly a consumer economy. When you look at the investment landscape, the thing that we point out is that this is probably one of the most challenging market outlooks during our career as a fundamental securities analyst and portfolio manager. And specifically, when we look at the things that make stocks go up or down, that is earnings growth, dividend yield, change in the number of shares that are outstanding due to repurchases and so forth, and basically the change in the valuation or re-rating or derating of stocks, it's tough to make an argument that any of those are going to be tailwinds as they have been to the same degree over the last few years. So we think this is going to be an environment where high active share and active management, concentrated portfolios is something that is going to be where investors can potentially generate alpha. And if you're looking at total sources of return between beta and alpha, I would make the argument today that the future opportunity from beta is quite limited, if not asymmetrical, maybe to the downside. But the opportunity for alpha, because of the just proclivity for high flows into index funds and just kind of everyone on one side of the boat in the marketplace, leads to plenty of opportunity from a bottom up stock picking capability to deliver some type of return to investors who want exposure to equities.
Now, James, when you talk about bottom up fundamental analysis, in your eyes, how does valuation factor into that analysis?
Well, the price that you pay for an asset is the single most important determinant of whether or not that investment is going to be successful. So valuation at this stage in time for us needs to be correlated to some fundamental variable. And I think one of the things that's most disheartening to me as a fundamental securities analyst is that somehow price has become the only variable that seems to be referenced and utilized for any kind of predictive forecast by people. It's overwhelmed, you know, any type of conversation. People say, well, the stock is cheap simply because, you know, a stock may have declined by 15 or 20%, not because the relationship of that stock price to sales or earnings growth or asset efficiency or some other metric is indicative of essentially the value of that company. What we're thinking about at this stage is that we expect, and assuming that the PE multiple, the re-rating of stock from a valuation perspective, is unlikely to be the tailwind that has been in the future. What we want to look for is companies that can overcome a potential derating and continue to deliver very strong sales growth, gain economies of scale on their operating assets and their cost basis to deliver superior earnings growth, and in essence offset essentially what we foresee to be a market that, unlike the last few years, where just enjoying and appreciating PE multiple has really explained most of the returns to stocks as a whole. Now we think it's going to shift and look in the mirror, and the PE multiple is likely to decline, maybe very rapidly in terms of a potential dislocation in the market, or even if it just, in essence, degrades a little bit as earnings catch up into what is already very elevated valuations. And as I said at the outset, the average stock, whether looking at price to sales multiple or any other metric that takes into consideration profit margins and asset efficiency and others, is trading at the highest level ever.
Now, James, your fund, Center American Select Equity, uses what's called a tail hedge to protect against major downdrafts in the market, potentially. Given where valuations are, where are you positioned with that tail hedge?
Right now, we've taken a little bit of a change in tact in the fund, meaning that historically we have used S&P put options to provide the tail hedge to systemic dislocations, and we saw how well that paid off for the fund when we went through the drawdown episode in March of 2020, when the fears of the pandemic really reached their apex, and the fund was successful in basically providing, less than 60% of the drawdown that the overall market had during that period of time. We have now shifted, recognizing that when you look at what we call the systemic risk of the market, we would argue that it is concentrated in essentially a handful of stocks, the FANG stocks, Microsoft, Apple, Tesla, and others, basically. And from that perspective, this is unique, and having the experience of managing, you know, funds, American funds, and also being the head of global sector funds back in the late 90s, early 2000 for Credit Suisse Asset Management, I remember very clearly, you know, one of the things with technology stocks at that point in time, which was quite different than what we've witnessed thus far, is that you did have a fundamental deterioration in some of the traditional metrics like rate of change of sales growth, profit margin, asset efficiency, and others of some of the largest tech stocks at that point in time, Intel, Cisco, Computer Associates, Oracle, et cetera, et cetera. And then it was, for some reason, price momentum continued to overwhelm what we felt at that point in time was a deteriorating fundamental situation. And we were fortunate enough to actually be a seller of most of our technology stocks back in January of 2000, and, you know, had a very successful navigation of the choppiness that came about from the crash of the NASDAQ market back then. When you look, however, today, whether it's stocks like NVIDIA or Microsoft or Alphabet, these companies are continuing to put up just tremendous results in terms of year-over-year sales growth, expansion of profit margins. Almost their monopoly power is unique at any point in my investment career in trying to understand companies, and it's resulting in, you know, just tremendous operations and improvements, basically. So it's rare that you will see stocks collapse when fundamentals are improving at the rate that we're witnessing for some of these FANG stocks. That being said, the valuations are at extremes. Most of these companies trade well in excess of 10 times revenue, which has historically been a trigger point or warning sign, because you typically have competition come in, margins erode, they overinvest. But because of the monopoly power that many of these companies have, you don't see the same type of erosion, you know, currently. So what do you have? You have companies that are doing well. You have a giddiness of investors continuing to applaud, you know, the results, which, again, are admittedly are very good. But you have valuation risk. So our view has been that rather than use S&P options and, you know, have a broader sense of notional coverage on the overall portfolio, what we want to do is isolate the companies that we own within the portfolio. And we do own, you know, some of the FANGs. What we want to do is isolate the systemic risk or the risk from dislocation in that particular segment of the market. And basically, we have bought put options on the NASDAQ 100, which we think is a better or pure hedge to that systemic risk rather than the S&P 500. Because the other areas of exposure that we have within the fund, namely stocks in the energy sector, the industrial sector, and elsewhere, tend to be much more idiosyncratic at this point in time. And from that perspective, you know, because we have such a high active share against the S&P 500, we want to essentially, you know, we want to embrace the stock picking risk that we have within those idiosyncratic names that tend to not have the same degree of systematic risk that the FANGs do.
Now, switching gears just a little bit. So you manage two funds, the Center American Select Equity Fund, as well as the Global Listed Infrastructure Fund. Given what's going on in DC regarding infrastructure spending right now, what are your thoughts generally on that space as an investment for somebody that's perhaps 15, 20 years out from retirement?
What we do with the infrastructure fund is we view it very much as an equity income fund. What I mean specifically by that is we purposely will highlight and emphasize high dividend paying stocks, both U.S., other North American companies in Canada and elsewhere, and other developed markets. So the exposure levels that we have are to principally Europe, Japan, and North America. The fund has one of the higher distribution rates within the infrastructure space because the dividends are qualified in most cases. In essence, the yield that we're offering on the infrastructure fund actually is competitive, if not superior, to what traditional municipal bond funds used to offer, particularly on an after-tax basis. And we look at the infrastructure fund as being the beneficiary of being able to deliver that stream of income. And we're, I think, the only fund in the infrastructure category that pays that distribution out on a monthly basis, like a bond fund. But when we look at the capital appreciation potential for the infrastructure stocks that we hold within the portfolio, I would have to say that that is an area that we do expect some degree of positive re-rating from a valuation perspective. What I mean by that is that if you look at the details of the infrastructure bill that's been passed and potentially the social infrastructure bill that is likely to be passed as well, the amount of money that's going to go into, you know, physical construction and other things is important, yes. But one of the things that's more important that isn't even part of any of this legislation that has been happening since literally inauguration day is the regulatory environment has changed dramatically. It started with the cancellation of Keystone Pipeline. We've seen it in other pipelines being unable to clear any kind of regulatory hurdles to be constructed or completed. You're seeing new thresholds of lease availability for federal properties for oil drilling, et cetera, be completely hamstrung. You're seeing, in essence, the supply of the existing infrastructure be greatly limited. At the same time, the demand for power, the demand for pipeline assets, because of both the cyclical recovery coming out of the pandemic, as well as, in essence, just, you know, general GDP growth, leaves a lot of these companies in a position where, if you just simply look at supply and demand, you know, this is economics 101, where demand is increasing, you know, very rapidly, but the current administration is actually limiting supply. What do you have? Price goes up on a supply demand curve. So we're expecting actually a lot of the companies that we own in the space, pipeline assets, energy related utilities. I mean, if everybody's going to drive an EV car at some point in time, that would be great for the environment. But where do you think that power is going to come from? It's going to come from the utility sector, basically, to be able to get that through. So transmission lines, all those other things. And at the same time that the administration is encouraging people to move towards a lower carbon footprint in terms of automobiles and others, they're doing the opposite with regard to the actual supply or the expansion of supply and raising the regulatory burden of the companies that operate within that space. So we think we've got a very powerful investment opportunity using your example of over the next 10 to 15 years. And, you know, I own shares in both funds, and I kind of split my investments between the two of them. I eat my own soup, as I like to say. And I think the opportunity for infrastructure, both from an income standpoint, as almost as a bond substitute in this kind of negative real interest rate environment, potential inflationary environment, plus what I think is going to be a continuation of a supply constraint, makes these assets more valuable, and I want to own them.
Now, from a macro standpoint, we're in this very bizarre type of environment right now where those receiving Social Security got a nearly 6% cost of living adjustment, but you can go out and get yourself 30-year mortgage at 3%. From where you sit, we have inflation on the horizon. We have a bunch of low interest debt and bonds out there. What are your general thoughts on bonds and fixed income as an investment at this point in time?
I think if you look at most bond funds, I don't know how they meet their investment objective anymore. I mean, the essence of a bond fund is to provide, in essence, capital stability and to provide current income. So where interest rates are today, and when you look at things, particularly on a net of expenses basis, what do you have? You have, in essence, no income. On a real basis, you have negative income, as you rightly pointed out, when you take into consideration inflation. And you have the potential where, let's just say, we do have an accident in the bond market where the dollar somehow loses its reserve currency and yields spike up. You have, in essence, a potential for tremendous capital loss. You know, people forget, you know, if you have a 10% decline in the price of your bond at this stage, that wipes out almost 6 years of income on an intermediate term bond. That doesn't even take into consideration the impact of inflation. So you have, in essence, an asymmetrical environment right now. I'm of the belief, however, that the Fed is going to, even though it's announced that it's going to begin its tapering of bond purchases. And let's remember, tapering of bond purchases doesn't mean they're becoming restrictive. It just means that they're actually buying less bonds at this point in time, even though they already own more than half of the outstanding intermediate term bonds that have been issued and are actually outstanding at this point in time. The kind of bond vigilantes that used to be there to kind of provide the sanity to treasury prices have been marginalized. So I think we're going to witness a prolonged period of negative real interest rates, and the negative ramifications to valuations on bonds is asymmetrical and not in an investor's favor. So I that's why we push the attractiveness of equity income. And from our standpoint, you know, infrastructure, and that's why we launched this fund a few years ago. In anticipation of fixed income becoming almost a dying asset class per se, but being able to offer, you know, some degree of inflation hedge, but also current income to investors. And I think, you know, investors are really in a very tough spot. We're likely to see this environment stay in place for a long period of time. And I don't think the Fed is going to be, despite what it said, going to be out of the purchasing of treasury bonds for the foreseeable future, because there's zero capability for anybody to have kind of a real level of interest rates determined by the market, because the Treasury is continuing to issue, you know, gobs and gobs of debt financing, and the ability to cut social, military, or other kind of service expenditures, the appetite for that is essentially zero in Washington by either political party.
Okay, James, so we're in this environment where bond investing potentially isn't doing a lot for investors at this point in time. So equity obviously becomes that much more attractive. But with that, does that not create sort of a feedback loop where investors are pulling money out of bonds, dumping it into the stock market, and in many cases, dumping it into market cap weighted index funds? So the bigger companies will just continue getting bigger and trade at higher and higher valuations. So from where you sit, does that sound like a plausible outcome of the current economic conditions?
Yes. And that's what we're seeing right now. And, you know, one of the things that we mentioned in our outlook piece is that one of the theories, academic theories going around right now, is this concept of inelastic market hypotheses, which means it's a fancy word of saying that, you know, stocks go up because people buy stocks. So we've replaced, you know, sales growth, earnings, PE multiples, examinations, risk premiums, et cetera, now with, you know, the theory that we just print money, we create, you know, $3 trillion of wealth out of thin air in the crypto and other, you know, intangible space. And all of this somehow needs to, you know, will make its way into, you know, stock markets, real assets, you know, consumer prices and things like that. This is it's really an upside down world. But I think you need to step back, right? You know, think about, you know, the environment that we're in and just take a breath, right? What we have done over the last, you know, decade or so, I think we're going to potentially pay a very severe penalty and the consequences from kind of this misdirected investment over the last decade of capital to intangibles versus tangible assets, I think is something that is going to play itself out with regard to, you know, continued supply disruptions and other things. I think, you know, one of the things I always ask people to do is to think about, you know, when you think about the value in your life of intangibles versus tangible assets. When Facebook with, you know, Instagram and WhatsApp, you know, had a 6-hour outage, you know, back on October 4th, when it was out for 6 hours, did it really change your life all that much? I mean, I don't even have a Facebook account. I didn't even notice it, basically. So it was like, who cares, right? But when in February, last February, when we had the winter storms in Texas, when Texas had a power outage, you know, and millions of people lost their power because we have a terrible infrastructure grid, even in, you know, the energy state of all, you know, it really is a key issue here in the sense that, you know, you had 100 people die. There was no drinking water in parts of the state. Millions of people lost power, et cetera. You know, I urge people to think about, you know, what the consequences will be for this kind of misdirected capital allocation to intangibles and, you know, avatars, whatever you want to call, you know, where we're going, you know, and think about the depleted state of the energy infrastructure, the utility infrastructure, real assets in general, chemicals. And, you know, our view is that these assets are going to become much more valuable as we progress. And you're starting to see earnings leverage in these companies because their products are needed on a daily basis. And, you know, we're letting the names that we bought, you know, last year in the depths of kind of the rotation out of cyclicals in the chemical space, the mining space, the energy space, you know, we're continuing to let those stocks just run because we continue to see these companies gaining the economies of scale and providing earnings leverage. And as long as they stay disciplined in their capital spending, and there's no indication that that's not going to be the case across the board. You know, you look at names like Chevron and Exxon, they're basically spending only, you know, 20% of their cash flow on capital spending. They used to spend over 100% routinely now, and none of these companies are planning on changing their capital spending structure. So we think this is an environment that is going to lead to bottlenecks, excellent pricing power, but a great opportunity for stock pickers in things outside of those passive segments that you talked about. But they will definitely be beneficiaries of kind of this monetary largesse that we've been witnessing.
So is it safe to say that you're not dumping your life savings into digital pictures of rocks or cryptocurrency at this point?
You know, I'm in my mid-50s, so I just throw my hands up and I say, I just don't get it. I frankly don't understand how any of this stuff is worth anything other than zero. I've been reading, I always try to basically educate myself on things that I don't know about. And I have read more things over the last year and a half, basically trying to appreciate, you know, where there was essentially value. And I get, you know, the only thing I can think about is that, you know, this is, you know, people don't have the same fascination that I may, or not fascination, but appreciation of precious metals as a store of value, even though they've been a store of value for, you know, thousands of years, basically. I mean, the creation of the crypto space, the only thing I could think of having some degree of a historical parallel is, you know, Cortez and his conquest of Mexico and Pizarro's conquest of Peru, you know, bringing back all this gold and silver back to Spain, which, you know, increased the money supply because gold and silver was money back in the 16th century. And, you know, this new gold that was found, you know, that previously was only available in certain areas crimped the money supply growth in Europe, you know, just exploded. Now you have, you know, the mining of digits, basically, instead of the, you know, the mining of gold and other precious metals. But, you know, people, I would urge people to recognize and understand their history, that, you know, the inflationary consequences of the increase of money supply from the conquest of Mexico and Peru, you know, by the conquistadors and what it actually did to Spain, money supply and debasement and other, you know, really detrimental impact to, you know, the Spanish economy and monetary, you know, conditions. I would urge people who are looking at this $3 trillion, which is essentially just, you know, come to life out of nothing, literally nothing, you know, to understand the consequences of what this might have with regard to inflation and other things on a broader perspective. So, you know, I like, I own a farm. I like real things. I plant trees. I mean, I just, I'm not, I consider myself a tangible person. I'll leave it at that. So,
I guess I won't expect to see any digital trees in your metaverse farm anytime soon then, James, right?
I can't eat a digital apple or a digital pear, I'll tell you that.
Well, on that note, James, we appreciate your time today. Always love to hear your insights. Thank you so much for joining us again today.
Well, thank you for the opportunity again, and best of luck to everybody.
Well, folks, that'll do it for today. Again, this is the Gordon Asset Management Podcast. Make sure to like and subscribe for updates. Also, if you want to learn more about James, his firm, and the funds he manages, feel free to check out his websites, centerfunds.com and centeresset.com, spelled C-E-N-T-R-E.
My raps are raw. I dribble like a basketball. Slobber on myself.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, be sure to click subscribe. Gordon Asset Management, LLC is a registered investment advisor. For more information about our firm, please visit wealthqb.com. The information in this podcast is presented for educational and entertainment purposes only and is subject to change without notice. Opinions expressed are those of the participants and don't necessarily reflect those of Gordon Asset Management, LLC, its producers, hosts, or guests. Information presented should not be construed as tax, legal, or investment advice, or a recommendation or solicitation for the sale of any product or strategy. Listeners are encouraged to seek advice from qualified professionals to determine whether any information presented may be suitable for their specific situation. Investments involve risks. Neither Gordon Asset Management, LLC, nor its podcast participants shall be liable for losses resulting from decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on this podcast.